The Public Safety Finance Division will come to order. Welcome back, members. I think we decided to have this hearing today on the cost of sexual violence in the state of Minnesota. And I think that it's timely that we do this. I had no intention when we set this up that, that the governor's bonding request would not be in the bill on the sex offender program. And this is getting a lot of feedback here. This is getting a little feedback. And nor did I anticipate the governor introducing a bill on increasing the sentencing for sex offenders. So this is timely that we have this discussion. And so that is basically the agenda. I wanted to announce just a slight change here in terms of staff. Libby Wyrum, as you know, was the committee legislative assistant in past years, and now she's officially the committee administrator for the committees, and she'll be very helpful to you, anything that you may need. And Lisa Gonzalez is the committee legislative assistant, and she's going to be great, and she's we also appreciate the fact that she's got a law degree that will help in our committee work, so we're pleased about that. And Ben's not here. I have an intern that's here, but he's supposed to be here, and he's not here. But we do have a quorum, so I would ask for a motion to approve the minutes for the meetings on April 7th, is that right?
Yep.
January 25th and October 7th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom moves the minutes of those meetings. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Okay, then we're going to get right into this because we have a limited amount of time, and I want everyone to, all of the presenters, to provide us with the best possible information. I think this is going to be an ongoing discussion that we're going to be having, and even though the Minnesota Sex Offender Program does not come under the auspices of this committee vis-a-vis financing, clearly it's connected with how we deal with sexual violence in the state of Minnesota and what offenders get put into the DOC facilities and what offenders get put into the MSOP program. So have, without any further ado, Dennis Benson, Dan Storkamp, and is it Janine Herbert? Dennis is the executive director. Mr. Storkamp is the deputy director, and Ms. Herbert is the clinical director. So take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm Dennis Benson, the executive director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. We're going to go through this PowerPoint very, very quickly. You have a copy in your packets, I understand, so you can refer to that, and then we hopefully will have a few moments for some questions. Basic program facts: today we have about 552 in the program, 700 staff, full-time equivalent, annual budget of about $65 million, and we also have 63 dual commitments over in the DOC. So with those, we're over 600 who are under civil commitment in Minnesota. This next slide, again, just underscores the profile of our population. And indicates what the trend line has been for the last 10 years. We've gone from 149 to 521. The average age is right in there around 36 to 55. This is unlike prison population. It's a much more Caucasian population than we have in our prison system, about 76%. You can see the additional breakdown. This next slide just indicates where we fall. There's been a lot of chatter about the size of our program. We are a large program. We're next to only California and Florida in terms of total size, but per capita we are the largest in the nation.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Dan Starkamp, the Deputy Director of Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Go through the next slides fairly quickly. I know this committee knows these very well. Sentencing guidelines information.
Mr. Starkamp, yeah, I mean, we do have time, so okay. I mean, I don't want to rush you guys too much. I think you just take your time. Okay.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Okay.
The next slide shows the sentencing guidelines information for the last 10 years, showing criminal sexual conduct sentences and convictions have been about 600 and have been at that rate for the last several years and hasn't changed one way. On the next slide, looking at the first degree offender convictions from guidelines information, this information, as you can see on the left side of the chart,
we don't have copies of the slides, so we're going to try to get those, but you probably can't see. Did you make slides? Who was supposed to have?
If we could just get them after.
Okay. Some members have them. If you don't, we will unapologize. We will get them for you. But so, Mr. Storkamp, you'll have to explain the slides in a little more detail, maybe.
Thank you. What you're looking at here are the actual convictions for criminal sexual conduct overall for Minnesota. This is sentencing guidelines information, and it shows anywhere between 512 is the lowest point and 607 is the highest point, but it's been averaging in the last between 2003 and 2008 anywhere between 580 up to 607. So it's really been a consistent number of being convicted of criminal sexual conduct. The next slide shows a breakdown of the first degree. The first degree.
Hold on one second. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify. Is that people sentenced to prison, or is it all sentences in the state for sex offenders, or who is in that slide?
Mr. Storkamp.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, it's all sex offenders in Minnesota for criminal sexual conduct. Next slide, I actually break down some of those that go to prison. What we looked at in the next slide is just the first degree. So if you take a look at the first degree criminal sexual conduct convictions between 2000 and 2008, ranges from 95 up to 165, but the last couple of years have been between 120 and 150, and they're fairly consistent. About 70% or just over of those convictions are actually sentenced to prison. When they go to prison, they're averaging 160 months. So they're going to be in prison between 8 and 10 years before they'll even be considered or be released and be considered for the program, for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, or the civil commitment process.
Would you say that again, Mr. Durkamp? What is the average sentence, then, of the first degree? Say that again.
Mr. Chair and members, for a specific example, in 2008, of the 144 individuals convicted, 72% went to prison, and they went to prison for 163 months on average.
So why wouldn't all first degree sex offenders go to prison?
Mr. Chair and members, I think there are circumstances and departures that the sentencing guidelines and judges use depending on the circumstances of the offense type. But again, for those details, the guidelines would have to provide those details or the courts. It's about 30% or 28% that don't go to prison, but they will be on probation and maybe have all other alternatives provided to them at that time.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Of the, do you know of the 72% for 08, how many of those, you say that's the average number, how many, if any, of those are seeing prison without hope of any parole?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Stewart,
and Representative Smith, I've actually got a slide that I'll show next.
All right, thank you.
The indeterminate sentencing, life without, or life sentences for sex offenders went into effect August 1st, 2005. In 2006, one offender was given that sentence. In 2007, there was four. In 2008, there was three. In 2009, guidelines are still working on their data, but they found two so far. So there'll be at least two. There'll probably be a few more as they get their data in. But this is a small number anticipated compared to what I know this committee was looking at when this went into effect 5 years ago. The next slide kind of shows some interesting trends as well in referrals. I think everybody knows what 2003 brought us with a lot of referrals. It's been averaging 150 to 170. With this last year that we just got information from the Department of Corrections, the referrals were down to 114. And given the newness of this information, I'm not sure we've got enough information about why that's going down, but we have recycled some individuals through the system, so we may not have as many probation violators coming back. Is only a guess at this point. But I guess, Department of Corrections could probably do analysis down the road and what that is, or they may even have some information available. Mr. Chair and members, about 50%
of those... Mr. Sturkamp, we have one question. Representative Bingham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just because, one, I haven't had my full latte yet, but two, these are just the referrals. These are not the approvals. And so you're going to get to that in a second?
Mr.
So I didn't miss that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham, I was just going to mention that.
Okay.
Up until 2009, the last year, we don't know, but it's been about 50% of those that are referred did come to the did get civilly committed into the program. And again, I don't know what the last year is because of the time frame it takes for the process to go into effect. Switching gears a little bit here, looking at our per diems. The Minnesota Sex Offender Program's per diem was $387 back in 2007, with $10 million in savings over the last couple of years, as well as an increase in our population at the same time of about 100 clients. Our per diem has dropped down to $328 a day. We're anticipating when Phase 2 is built, if it is funded by the legislature and built and full, it'll be down to $250 in today's dollars. And if you look at some of the other states, we've got everything from Florida to Washington State, quite a range. And realize not everybody counts per diems the same way. I know Gary Carter's looked at this for corrections across the country. It's no different for this program. It's different ways of reporting. Minnesota has a very fully loaded per diem in our process, and I'll show you that in a second. But with 250 or even the 328, we're right in the middle of several of the other programs that are out there.
So, Mr. Sturkamp, these other states, these are sort of quasi-hospital prison programs like we have in Minnesota then?
Mr. Chair, the civil commitments around the country are all different in both who comes in and the type of programming that they have.
Okay.
But they are similar to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program for civil commitment process.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
On the next slide is our fully loaded per diem. What you see here is our operating per diem on the top half with the additional items that are required by legislation that we include, including statewide indirect, indirect costs from the department, building depreciation, bonding interest, as well as capital asset depreciation. Our facility operating budget is around $300 a day with another $25 or $28 for the additional costs.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to talk a little bit now about what's driving the need for this bonding project. This shouldn't be surprising. We've just continued the trend line from last year's discussion on our population growth. As you can see, we started 2009 at 521. We are anticipating now the next 6 years that we're going to increase about 66 a year. Based on projections going forward. So while that number is down from last year, we're still seeing a strong growth in this program. And as of January 1st, I believe this year, we were at 31 new admits for the fiscal year, and we were projecting 62, so we were exactly half of that. So our projections have been pretty close.
Mr. Benson, maybe this is too big of a question, and I haven't thought it through enough in my own mind, but since the governor's announced his bill, if the legislature were to adopt those increases, and if first-degree sex offenders were incarcerated for longer periods of time and mandated to get treatment in our DLC facilities, would you anticipate that would there be fewer than civil commits when these individuals had completed their sentences, thereby reducing your bed projection at the MSOP?
Mr. Chair and members, we have a joint program, I think you recall, that we operate in the Department of Corrections at the Moose Lake Correctional Facility. It's a 50-bed program. These are people that go into this program are sort of pre-designated as potential civil commits when they reach the end of their prison sentence. So our staff go over there and provide treatment. It's a 50-bed program. Today, I believe there's a waiting list of 300, so we're not able to treat all those people. Certainly, if that program were expanded, I honestly do believe people could be diverted from civil commitment. Even under current laws, current practice, and current statute, we're not able to reach all of those people. Certainly not all of them. We have some numbers. We didn't bring them today, but we know of, since this program's inception back in 2001, I believe, there are 42 people that went through the program that were not civilly committed. Now, is that because they went through the program? We don't have a comparative analysis, but certainly I think one could make the argument that some of those people would have probably been civilly committed had they not gone through this program. So I think, yes, I believe that more treatment and corrections at the front end would certainly divert some folks from potentially being civilly committed. I think we've got to get some history with this law. We all thought that this life without parole thing would, I think, get more traction than it has. Certainly there would be more people in prison for a longer period of time if we had more time to treat them, or if the DOC did. I think that would have a positive impact. But I think we first need to understand how the prosecutors and judges would manage this additional sentencing option. And that's always a best guess, but certainly there would be more people in prison for a longer period of time.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the beds that you currently have, when do you project the program will be completely full?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, we believe we're going to be full sometime between probably about August of 2012 and December of 2012. We need to understand that there are about, I believe, 1,600 sex offenders currently in the DOC who would not be impacted by this sentencing change if it were passed into law. So I always say the 400 beds expansion that we're requesting today, those beds are all spoken for the most part. I think turning this ship around on a dime is going to be very, very, very challenging, because there are people in the pipeline. And given the capacity of treatment programs and corrections at this point, there are going to be limits in terms of how many are going to be diverted from civil commitment. So we're basing our projections again on, and our need on, current law, current practice, and who is in the pipeline.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if this legislature expanded your 50-bed program that's currently in the Department of Corrections to the 300 people that were on the wait list, in proportion to how many so far it looks like have been diverted, about what percentage of those 300 do you think would not be going, if just looking at the success you've already had?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I would only be guessing. And the other point that I would make is this: while this program has been in operation since 2001, we believe that there were some issues with that program until about a year ago. We believe going forward we're going to be able to show better results than the previous 5 or 6 years. I'd like some time to discuss that with staff, and we can certainly get back to you with a number, or maybe at a future hearing we can have that discussion. But it would be a wild guess. Mr. Chair and members, this is the what the landscape looks like right now in terms of our bed space plan. You've seen models like this for many years that Dan and I put together in corrections. Basically, to cut to the chase here, 2009, we just moved out of the DOC annex over at the Moose Lake Prison. That's indicated by the white bars. We're now into the yellow, and again, consistent with Representative Hillstrom's question, we are going to be full in 2012, and we do need those phase two beds by the end of 2012. The other point I want to make, though, about this bonding proposal, and we'll get to that, but it's more complex than beds. When the first 400 beds were bonded, the legislature did not include the infrastructure. So we are serving food out of a kitchen that was designed for 100 clients. We have, I think, 10 treatment rooms. We don't have any therapists in those units, because we've converted offices to therapy rooms. We don't have enough mental health rooms. We have health care limitations. We have all of these other program initiatives, education, that we simply don't have space for. Spiritual center, visiting, we just don't have the infrastructure to manage the 550 that we will have when phase one is full, because the infrastructure was designed for a population of 100 to 150. Again, jumping to budget, we are bringing the budget, I think, in the right direction. 2008, we were at $75 million. This year, we're at $64.8 million. Despite the growth, we've also cut our staff complement by about 210 full-time equivalent positions in the last 2 years, so we have leaned out the program, trying to be mindful of state resources. Getting to the bonding, this is what the campus looks like currently. The MSOP main building was the original 100 and then eventually expanded to 150. Complex 1 that you see at the bottom was what we call phase 1. It's a star-like building that holds 400, and then you can see where phase 2 is designated to go. This breaks down the 400 bed and the infrastructure that we're requesting in our bonding proposal. We simply have to get additional treatment rooms, food service, health services area, mental health, and all of these infrastructure necessities to manage this population. We are under a different kind of gun than corrections is in terms of offering treatment. We don't have the option of treating 20% of the sex offenders or providing education based on capacity. We are mandated to provide treatment with this population, everybody who wants it. The other thing that's occurred in the last 3-4 years is the treatment participation has gone from about 50% up to close to 90%. We now have 4 people in the community preparation service program. That's the last step before somebody would be provisionally discharged. So I think that has started to give hope to this population that the wheels are slowly starting to turn and that there may ultimately, the courts may choose to ultimately provisionally discharge somebody. So despite that, even if we do start to see a trickle out of the program, we're never going to be releasing these people the way that, or the courts won't, I don't believe, the way that they come out of corrections. My clinical director, Janine, told me this morning that out of the 4,500 civil commits so far in America, about 400 have been provisionally discharged or discharged. So it's about 10% nationwide. So we are not as much of an anomaly as some folks think. We're not the only program that hasn't released anybody. We have to understand who we're dealing with here. These are the people that have fallen through lots of screens out of the 18,019 registered sex offenders. We're dealing with the 500 that have been designated for this program. So I'm going to ask Dan.
Mr. Benson, before we have a question, Representative Haas.
Thank you. And if it's a complex question, I'd take an answer afterwards. If we're not releasing this as an aging population, or eventually will be an aging population, which should put something at a time that a nursing home, maybe a hospice care, are we releasing now to any such facilities? And what percent will do you predict will be in that category?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Halls, we have a forensic nursing facility on the St. Peter campus that the state hospital system runs. So that is a resource for us, for our aging population. And yes, we do have folks that are aging out in this program since I've been there, not just under 2 years. I think we've lost 7 or 8 to death. So there are folks that are end of life and dying while confined to this program.
Representative Haas.
Thank you. That's fine.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair and members, the next slide is that Mr. Benson talked about here. The infrastructure or the program safety issues are significant. When we built the additional 400 beds, our food service stayed the same, about 1,500 square feet. When we have 950 clients, we're going to need over 15,000 square feet. Our treatment rooms, our clinical director can address this as well. There was very few treatment rooms within our current structure. And again, we just built the beds this last time, so we went from 4,000 square feet, what we currently have, to needing almost 25,000 square feet. It's a critical need. I think overall, we're about 160,000 square feet currently, which was designed for 100. We went to 150. Now we've got 400 using that same space, and we ultimately need about 600,000 square feet because that infrastructure wasn't built during phase one.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
On this slide, if you'd go back, the I'm curious, small point, but I'm still curious on the treatment rooms. The average space of one treatment room, and when, at what time on the clock are they used during a day, standard day?
Mr. Storkamp.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Janine Abair. I'm the Executive Clinical Director of MSOP. I may be able to respond to that.
Please.
We range between 8 and 10 clients in a group with 2 co-facilitators, so figure 10 or 12 folks in a room. We do treatment, sex offender-specific treatment programming between regular business hours of 7:30 to 4:30. The rooms are used after hours. I'll talk in a moment about rehab services, which would be recreation, vocational, and education services.
Would it, Matt, Mr. Chairman, would it be possible to get the same use out of existing space by running 3 shifts during a 24-hour period like some factories work their employees?
Ms. Siever.
Mr. Chair, Representative, perhaps I'll speak to that in one moment about what a treatment day would look like and why we structure it the way that we do. The short answer would be that the clients that we are treating, we are preparing with any luck and hard work on their part to reintegrate into society. And so they do their treatment during a period of time, and then they do their programming later in the day, which has to do with how they behave in other settings to demonstrate their change and to see if they are integrating what they've learned in treatment. So they do their work hours and they do their education hours and recreation hours with therapeutic staff in other setting times. So when someone isn't in a sex offender treatment group, they may be at the gym or they may be working in the kitchen or they may be in education. So most of that programming occurs in the evening hours. Whether we flip that and do sex offender programming in the evening, we would still be doing rec and vocation and education then during the other hours.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
But if you divided the day into 3 time blocks, day shift, evening shift, and the swing shift, you could do it on the existing space.
Ms. Ebert. Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think the issue is each client only is in group therapy 2 hours a day. So we have enough space in that 8-hour block to do the 2 hours, those various groups of 8 to 12 during the day. That's enough time. I mean, as the population grew, we then have to also hire another group of therapists, which would be very expensive to put on the evening shift, and another group to put on the midnight shift. So you'd have 3, you'd be tripling your therapists to get the most mileage out of those group rooms. But again, they would only be available for an additional shift, because that second shift they're going to be used for that vocational and whatnot. So The other point I would make is this is a civil program for civil commits, not criminal commits, so we have to be a little bit careful about how the court would view this 24-hour-a-day operation, too. I think, while it's certainly something that we could explore, I think there would be limitations.
Ms. Ebert, are you prepared now to, are you done, Mr. Sturkamp? Because we were running behind, as I thought we might, but.
Mr. Chairman, one or two questions back on the life without parole issue. You showed 2 years, 06, 07, and 08. Only one, four, and three, which is roughly 2.5 persons per year receiving life without parole since the law was passed. Did you provide input at the time we discussed the bill in 05 as to your projection of how many individuals would be sentenced to life without parole? And if so, what was that number?
Mr. Sturkamp.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, we did provide a bed pack impact at that time, and I don't recall off the top of my head what those numbers were.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, just one last question. I guess I would like to see, as soon as you can collect it, a couple of things. What your bed impact was, and find the fiscal note on that. It strikes me, Mr. Chairman, that if the projection was substantially higher than 2.5 per year, the fiscal note probably could be re-looked at, and you might find some savings in the money that was given 4 years ago that isn't being used.
Mm-hmm. Looks like Mr. Carter found it. So we'll make copies of that and make that available to the committee. Are you prepared now to talk about the treatment program? Anything else? Okay, very good.
Continue, Mr. Chair, please. Members, this slide just illustrates that this is a complex clinical picture of clientele. The term sex offender is a legal term, and it's not a clinical term. And so I can have two individuals who've committed the same sex offense, and in the eyes of the law, they're very similar, but clinically, they look very different. This is a population with higher concentration of symptomology, mental illness, psychopathy. These are folks who don't have first-time offenses. They have long chronic patterns of sexual offending behavior. As I mentioned earlier, MSOP is set up and structured differently from DOC in that it's a 24/7 treatment program. And so any sex offender treatment program is really about behavior modification. Our goal is to change their behavior. Recidivism is the issue. So what we do with folks in treatment is we provide them with information to make different decisions about their lives. But in MSOP, we measure where they make those decisions in other settings. It's an artificial environment, and we have to keep in mind that we're limited with what we have. So how someone acts on the job, how someone does in school, how someone does, quite honestly, in recreation, and I may have commented this to some of the other settings, but when you think about someone who is a pedophile and who has associated with 6- and 7-year-old boys all of his life, for him to play basketball successfully in the gym with peers is definitely a treatment issue and would contribute to hopefully decreasing his risk in recidivism down the road. So we have a multidisciplinary team. When we talk about treatment progress, we access information from all staff, not just the clinical staff who've seen them in group for 2 hours.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You stated that these folks have a pattern. If you have any data that you could give us about the offenders and how many criminal history points or offenses that they have, just so we could get a clear picture of who these folks are. You don't have to do that today, but that would be helpful.
Certainly, Representative. Mr. Chair?
Continue, please.
The program is designed into three phases. As Mr. Benson spoke, not all of our clients are participating in treatment. Folks have the right to refuse treatment. We can't make people make changes. We try to entice them and provide carrots and sticks to the degree that we can to engage people in treatment. First phase of treatment is an opportunity to indicate the relationship between thoughts and behavior. We're pretty familiar with the level of cognitive distortions that these individuals have with how they see the world. Second phase of treatment really is the meat and potatoes, if you will, of treatment. It identifies the underlying issues in their offending behavior and resolves those issues. Phase three of treatment is the maintenance phase and the stability phase to see if they can maintain these changes over a long period of time. The courts send us referrals, and we have a very heterogeneous population. This is a slide that indicates what Moose Lake programming looks like. As the pictures that Dennis and Dan showed earlier, in the main building, we have units of 25-bed units. and those units are designed for specialty programming. We have folks with severe persistent mental illness in one of the units. We do have a unit for individuals who we call our young men's unit. These are folks who have been civilly committed up through the juvenile system. They're between the ages of 19 and 25. They're very institutionalized, very under-socialized, and quite vulnerable to our other population of gentlemen. We have a behavior unit. We have an assisted living unit, which is what the representative may have been considering when we speak of folks who need medical care, but not quite to the level of a nursing home. We have a unit for people with higher needs. Out on Complex 1 is where we house our non-participants and conventional programming. Mr. Benson did speak briefly about our 50-bed program, which is located over at the Moose Lake Prison. And we do have a slide here, and again, in response to Representative Hillstrom, it is preliminary data looking at that. The goal of the program in the prison, not only in my mind, is to see diversion of civil commitments, but also should someone participate for a period of time in that program, or even complete, and the courts still civilly commit them, they would come to us and not start from scratch, because our staff would know their clinical picture and be able to move them more efficiently through treatment. Of the four individuals that are currently residing in our community preparation services, one of those individuals completed this program, and he went through the primary treatment much quicker than his three peers. Down at St. Peter, we have two main populations. One is the alternative population, which is individuals who are lower functioning. This is a unique and especially challenging group of folk. They have cognitive deficiencies and an executive functioning impairment. So they may be traumatic brain injury. They may be IQ levels. They may have profound learning disabilities that they can't be successful in conventional programming. In addition to the alternative program down at St. Peter, we start our reintegration process. And those are folks in that third phase of treatment I spoke of earlier. And they're located in what we call MSOP, Supervised Integration Unit. And individuals at that stage of treatment have ankle bracelets, and as they progress through treatment, they achieve levels of privileges. They're allowed to walk, eventually they're allowed to walk on campus down in St. Peter, escorted by staff, eventually into the community, escorted with staff, and then eventually into on the campus, unescorted, of course, all with ankle bracelets and with security in mind. If we go to the next slide, this is an overall picture of the program. So if you can imagine the first three steps of this, we make clinical decisions to progress folks through when they come in the door, through primary treatment, and then through MSI. It is the court's decision to place an individual at any point in treatment into what we call the Community Preparation Services, CPS, and that is currently a house outside the secure perimeter down in St. Peter campus. Again, then the courts make the decision if someone is to be provisionally discharged, and then it's the courts that make the decision for eventual full discharge. So while we provide clinical information to the courts, it is ultimately their decision when they place someone outside the secure perimeter.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me how frequently the court reviews that, or does it take a motion by someone to do that?
Ms. Hebert.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. When anyone is civilly committed in Minnesota, every 6 months they have the opportunity to petition to the Special Review Board. The Special Review Board makes recommendations. In the case of our clients, the Special Review Board makes recommendations to the Supreme Court of Appeals panel, or what's commonly called SCAP, and those are the folks that make the decision whether or not to move someone down along the line. So it's it is on the client to petition every 6 months.
Mr. Hillstrom. So, but is that correct? Nobody has been released from the facility as of date, right? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, in the history of MSOP, there has been one release that was out into the community on provisional discharge, and the person was brought back into the program. So currently, there's never been someone who's gone through provisional discharge to full discharge.
And as a treatment provider, can you, I'm just curious of what would be the motivation for a, quote, patient to participate in treatment knowing that they're never going to get out of that facility.
Mr. Chair, I think that's an astute observation. I have qualitatively noticed the changes in clients who are engaging in treatment. I think that hope is a human quality that we need to have if you're going to make very, very difficult changes. When our current clients who are on the CPS campus were moved out to the house, we literally took photographs of the house and the clients in that house and sent it up on a board in the hallway at Moose Lake because those individuals didn't believe it was happening. So as far as motivation for folks who are in treatment, they do need to see a light at the other end of the tunnel.
And do you believe that any of these individuals could reintegrate into society and not be a risk to our communities if they were released?
Mr. Chair and members, what we know about human nature is that ultimately it's an individual's decision. What research tells us about sex offenders, and when we say sex offenders, there's a continuum and a spectrum of that behavior and pathology, that supervision and treatment are the two components that will be the safest bet with regard to recidivism. So how someone is released, I would never expect a sex offender to go from any treatment program straight in the community without supervision or without ongoing aftercare or maintenance planning. So I think it's possible. I think ultimately it's that individual's decision. When you have supervision tied with someone who's placed in the community, you can do technical violations hopefully before they ever recidivate sexually. And so for civil commitment programs across the country that have released some individuals, they pull them back into the program, perhaps because they saw that they were late for work 2 days in a row. That may be a violation for them, and that may be the very early start of their cycle, so that we would know them well enough to catch them long before they made decisions that harmed another person.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies for missing the very beginning.
And let me just, before you start, I apologize to Mr. Kennedy from the DLC. We started running late, and we just thought, Mr. Kennedy, can you come back at a later time? I really apologize, but I'm just thinking I don't want to just give you 2 minutes to explain a very complicated law that will affect Minnesota. So you can stay if you'd like, if we can see what the schedule's like, but I wanted to allow this discussion to continue, so I apologize. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will absolutely try to keep.
No, it's okay. We have a little more time.
I apologize that I missed the presentation. I don't know if it was Mr. Benson or who, but on the very second slide, you have some statistics about the number of individuals who are currently committed and the number of staff. And if my math is correct, we've got about 1.5 staff per individual committed. And can you just speak to that? Because I understand the difference between people committed or people incarcerated in the corrections system and people in this program, but that seems to me to be a very high staff to patient ratio, and obviously there are a lot of costs associated with that. Can you just speak to that at least briefly?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, yes, we did speak to that very briefly. We are mandated to provide treatment, so a great deal of staff are in the area of clinical. We don't have the option of saying we're not going to treat you. We have clinical staff for prepared to treat everybody who's committed to the program. That drives the staffing number up. The right number is actually 700 full-time equivalents. That's down about 210. From 2 years ago, as the population increased about 115 to 120. So we've got this program about as lean as we're going to get it. When you look at the per diem, how it sits nationally, if you look at just the operational per diem, while we aren't the lowest, we certainly aren't the most expensive. We believe that with more efficiency, we can get that per diem down to about 250. So the other thing I would just underscore again is that treatment isn't from 8 to 4:30. We are doing things during the evening. That drives staff numbers up as well. So comparatively speaking, from where we were 2 years ago, we've cut staffing by over 20%. The new buildings are much more efficient, but there's just no way that we can compromise the number of clinical staff and keep this program constitutionally sound.
Mr. Chair, yes, I guess that hits on what will be my last question, and I appreciate that we are required to provide treatment, but where is the line in terms of how much treatment we have to provide and how many clinicians per, or how many patients per clinician? Is there a line, or are you doing your best to guess at what is constitutionally required? And I mean, is there some guidance if I wanted to say, we should have 25 patients per clinician, and I recognize that's probably ridiculous, but is there something that clearly says we can't do that constitutionally?
Ms. Hebert.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's best practices and standards of care in sex offender treatment with regard to group size, and to the degree that that is studied, we know that 8 to 10 folks in a group creates an efficient therapy group, and that holds true whether you're treating sex offenders or you're doing a group with individuals with regard to depression. To think that there are studies specifically that talk about civilly committed sex offender treatment, this is such a new phenomenon in the field that we build on best practices of sex offender treatment, keeping in mind that these are individuals that, because they're with us, are more concentrated in their symptomology and are quite honestly higher risk than any other sex offenders in the groups. So for us to stay at the best practices, I would say, would be the minimal treatment design with regard to research today.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, just a comment. I think that the response to the question, I understand that the department is trying to implement best practices, and I don't necessarily quibble with that, but if we as a legislature are going to make a decision, I mean, I think it's unclear as to what the courts would do with that. We can make some decisions around staffing levels. I'm not suggesting that we do, but obviously we've got a really expensive program here with results, Mr. Chair, as you were suggesting, that, you know, are we really getting what we're paying for? And I'm not sure what the best answer is with this population. I obviously don't want them out on the street in my neighborhood or yours. And I'm not sure what the answer is, but I think we need to be careful about, just continuing to put more money into a program like this without asking some of those hard questions.
I think that if there's no other questions, we probably should really have a joint hearing at some point with Representative Huntley's committee, I would think, and really kind of think this through from a financial perspective, given the bonding bill and the governor's proposal, and I think all of these very legitimate questions about what we do with this population. So any other questions? Thank you all for your presentation.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Okay, now we're going to hear from the Department of Corrections, Mr. Allen, on the sex offender program that we have at DOC. And then the final presentation will be the presentation by MnCASA dealing with prevention. Mr. Allen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Steve Allen. I'm the Director of Behavioral Health Services with the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and I've brought a presentation that is a brief overview of sex offender treatment programming in our state prison system. Managing the risk of sex offenders begins with identification and assessment of this population for our adult males that takes place at a reception facility in St. Cloud. All offenders coming into our system receive medical, mental health, chemical dependency, and sex offender assessments. And those sex offenders coming into our system requiring treatment are then given a treatment directive. They're then prioritized and put on a waiting list. As they arrive to their designated treatment programs, they'll receive a more detailed assessment, including psychological assessments, file review, clinical interview, will develop a treatment plan, and treatment itself will begin. This next slide shows the current resources that we have for treating this population, including a 200-bed treatment program at our Lionel Lakes at a medium custody facility that includes both sex offender and chemical dependency programming embedded in the same program. We have a 60-bed program at our Rush City facility that's close custody. For our juveniles, we have a 26-bed facility program at Red Wing. For our adult women, an 8-bed facility. The program that's been previously discussed here is a joint project with MSOP and Department of Corrections at our Moose Lake Prison. And at St. Cloud, we have recently shifted an existing chemical dependency program into a sex offender-specific chemical dependency program. For those sex offenders without time enough to complete treatment, they receive the chemical dependency portion of their treatment before being referred to a program out in the community, or they get diverted to our Rush City program for sex offender treatment if they do have enough time.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you refer someone to treatment outside, isn't it typically GMAC that would pay for that program once they got out?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, there are a variety of funding streams for a community-based program. The Department of Corrections, I believe, contributes about $2.5 million in grants for community programs to help support those. In some programs where folks are working in the community, take private health insurance, and yes, there are additional public funding streams that assist for those folks who aren't working or don't have other funds available.
Mr. Chair.
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just get some data from you about the number that you refer out of prison that have not been treated that then you rely on GAMC to use for treatment dollars, that would be helpful.
Just a couple of other comments about the joint program that we have in our Moose Lake prison. The targeted population, as was said, are those sex offenders who are most likely to be referred for civil commitment. It is for those offenders under the Department of Corrections. The program is staffed by MSOP staff and clinically supervised by MSOP staff. While the department oversees all operational components, the folks also do attend clinical staff meetings to coordinate care and maintain a continuity of care between our different programs. All of our Department of Corrections programs are certified. Our adult programs under 2965, our juvenile program under 2955, and that's under statute 24167. The standards apply to and provide a framework for the inspection and certification of our residential programs. Those are inspected every 2 years. Under those rules, there are requirements related to credentialing of staff, staffing ratios, clinical supervision, orientation, development of training, etc. And they also provide standards for the goals of the program, etc. This next slide provides a quick snapshot of activities around sex offender treatment in the department. There are about 800 sex offenders in the department and on any given day with a directive to attend treatment. We currently have about just under 350 in our programs. Over the last year, we had 31 complete. Another 47 participate successfully until release, and another 102 that did not successfully complete. Reasons for not completing: some offenders quit, they're administratively discharged, they don't make sufficient or adequate progress, or sometimes there's discipline violations, for instance, getting into a fight, that type of thing. So we're currently providing treatment services for about 23% of the 600 to 700 sex offenders who are released to the community each year.
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The number of treatment of sex offenders, I think I just heard you say, was 23%. It would be nice if we could get a breakdown of those that didn't get treatment because we didn't have enough bed space offered. And then my question would be, are they not getting treatment because you have asked for the money to treat them and we have not provided them? Or have you not asked for the money to adequately treat those that have been ordered to sex offender treatment?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we could certainly provide you the data that that you're requesting. We have asked in recent history for the 60-bed program up at Rush City that was recently built. We also are in the midst of a bonding proposal that we hope to bring before this group next year that would increase the size of our programming up at Rush City with a programming building. Part of that funding, if approved, would fund a group that we haven't been able to target as well. These are higher-risk sex offenders who come back to us as either probation violators or release violators. They have fairly short lengths of stay. We've been aware of this population but haven't had the programming to be able to reach that population because their lengths of stay are short enough.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you and the department, the sex offender treatment program, could get together and provide me information about how many we end up civilly committing, which you don't end up treating prior to them ending up there, it would be helpful to know if these are actually the folks that are failing out or dropping out or refusing to participate that end up getting civilly committed, or if these are the folks that are on your waiting list that nobody ever gets around to treating that then we end up civilly committing.
Sarah, can you when someone asks for information, would you provide it to the entire committee?
Certainly.
Okay. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you repeat, please, how many reintegrated into the community, back in the community?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
How many, what did you say? Did you say a number that were put back in the community untreated?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the department releases approximately 600 to 700 sex offenders each year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
Let me ask you about notification, community notification. Can I ask that question, Mr. Allen, please?
Yes, you may.
Pardon me?
Yes, you may.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Allen, when a sex offender comes from another state, can you tell me what that process is for notification, for community notification?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is not my area of expertise, how that process works.
Can I respond on that?
Someone that can answer that question. Why don't you ask another question before? Well, here he is. Mr. Mears, can you answer that briefly?
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Ken Mears. I'm Director of Administrative Services. When an offender applies to come to Minnesota under the Interstate Compact to transfer their supervision to us, we do the same process with them that we do with our sex offenders in prison. Their case goes before our review board. We assign a risk level to that offender. And then when that offender comes, they are subject to the same community notification laws that our own offenders would be.
Mr. Chair.
Some more.
Thank you, Mr. Mears. And let me just give you a case that happened within my district. There was a sex offender that lived in our community for approximately a year's time, from another state, and there was no notification at all until there was lack of communication. And I want to make one more point. This is for an offender, sex offender out of state, but there was another sex offender in state that was going to be released, and as the process started taking place, they realized that whoever was in charge did not contact the correct person to work out the rental agreement of their housing. They talked to somebody else other than the owner of the rental. What's with the communication, so that sex offender, there was no agreement for that sex offender to live where they said they were going to be living. So there's a two-part question there. But it's all based on communication, both out-state and in-state. Can you address that, please?
Mr. Mears.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it all depends on whether that individual has supervision and is under supervision. There will be offenders that come from another state that are currently not under supervision, and if they come, then they're just subject to the registration laws of the state. It's up to that person to contact local law enforcement for the registration part. If they do come through the compact, what the other state prepares a packet of transfer material, that material comes to our office, we send it out to the field to whatever agency has the supervision responsibility in that area, whether it's a CCA jurisdiction or whether it's a Department of Corrections agent. That goes out to the agent. The agent investigates the living arrangements that are being proposed within that transfer plan, and if they feel that that's an appropriate placement, then they will accept supervision of the case.
So last one, because we're going to move on.
Did I hear you right that it's up to the offender, if they're not supervised, to notify us that they're moving here?
If they're not under any current, Mr. Chair and Representative, if they're not under any current court-ordered supervision and they move to Minnesota, yes, it's that person's responsibility to notify local law enforcement that they are moving into the area and to register with them.
Okay. Maybe you can follow up with Representative Ward and clarify some of this also when the hearing's adjourned.
Absolutely.
We have two questions, and then I'm afraid we have other presenters, so, and then I'm going to ask Mr. Allen to sort of wrap it up in a couple of minutes. We'll have you back again also, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, this might be a little simpler question anyway. I'm just curious about how we compare to other states in terms of releasing sex offenders from prison without treatment. I mean, I think that we're all concerned about that. I think Representative Hillstrom's question was a good one. But how do we compare to other states?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. We have not looked at this comprehensively, but I have met with several groups of peers in various states and have asked that very question. My understanding from those more informal discussions is that Minnesota actually does fairly well in terms of its ability to provide treatment, including sex offender treatment, while in prison. There are other states that provide little, if any, sex offender treatment for sex offenders while imprisoned.
Representative Eastland, I have a brief question. I'm really running behind here.
Very brief. I mean, there's a wide range of things that can land you in prison as a sex offender. And I guess my question is of the 600 to 700 that we release every year, what's the recidivism rate for that group versus the recidivism rate for the general population?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, I want to make sure that I understand your question properly. We have done a number of studies, including one that's been recently published, which means that it met the rigors of the scientific community, that shows that treatment works. Our treatment programs work. And when we followed offenders for more than 9 years, over 2,000 over a period of time from 1990 through 2003, we had a very significant reduction in recidivism for those who participated in treatment. Now, if your question is related
what percentage?
We had a 27%, I'll flip to the side so that you folks can see it. It is in your handouts. It's slide number 13 shows the results of 27% reduction in recidivism for sex-related new sex offenses. 33% if you look at those who completed treatment or successfully participated until release, but even more so, and I think this is significant, treatment also reduced violent recidivism of any kind, not just sex offending, and also risk of rearrest for any crime by 18% for the first and 12% for the latter. So treatment works. I think that's important. The other study that I'll just mention briefly that follows is something that we published a couple of years ago, but I think is very significant. Treatment alone is not the answer. It's always been a partnership. And as was mentioned in the earlier presentation, good treatment coupled with very good intensive supervised release in the community achieves those kind of results. It's never just treatment. It's the coupling of those two and other partners within the community that helps manage the risk that this population presents.
Okay. Can I follow up with just one quick question?
I think I appreciate that information. I guess I was just looking for a simpler comparison. What is the recidivism rate in general of all prisoners released from DOC, and what's the recidivism rate of people specifically who are labeled as a sex offender?
Mr. Allen, do you have that information, or can you provide it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, my understanding is that the Department of Corrections general recidivism rate has been in the low 30s over a course of time. Sex offending recidivism, especially for those who have been treated, is lower than that.
Last question, Mr. Representative Hillstrom, and I'm going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you can probably provide this rather than give it now, but we've seen that treatment is important and intensive supervised release, and it would be interesting to see then what the recommendations for the budget has been in terms of the cuts that we've been making and whether that's impacted the supervised release portion.
I think when we go over the DOC budget, we should carve out a huge chunk of time for this and have Mr. Allen come back.
That would be great,
Mr. Allen. I hate to cut you off, but we have one final presentation for the hearing. I appreciate your testimony. Now we're going to talk about the cost of sexual violence. We have a presentation by Mincasa. You have roughly 20 minutes before we adjourn. We have with us Donna Dunn, who's the executive director of Mincasa, and we've asked the dean of the William Mitchell College of Law, Eric Janis, to also join us. Ms. Dunn, do you want to introduce yourself and make your presentation, please?
Thank you very much, Chair Pimar and Minority Leader Coles. Members of the committee, as you heard, my name is Donna Dunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. We represent over 70 member programs and allied professionals across the state who are committed to assisting victim survivors of sexual violence, as well as to help communities understand their role in responding to and preventing sexual violence. In the interest of time, I'm going to dramatically curtail my comments and defer most of the time to Dean Janis. I did want to say, however, in starting that you have in your packets a copy of the Minnesota Department of Health's report, The Cost of Sexual Violence in Minnesota, which was issued in 2007. Just a couple of highlights, and you also have in your packet a copy of our TPT DVD, acronym here, video that we did around the status of prevention and sexual violence intervention in Minnesota. Just some highlights from the cost report. I just will say very briefly, the cost of sexual violence, and as you've heard this morning, is great in Minnesota. The Health Department's report indicated that in 2005 there were most likely 61,000 victims of sexual violence in Minnesota. 61,000 victims, that's the size of a typical small town in Minnesota, or medium-sized town in Minnesota. We know that the cost then of that, of course, is extremely high. The cost report indicated that overall there's an $8 billion projected annual economic impact of sexual violence in Minnesota each year. $8 billion. Perhaps the most troubling finding from the cost of sexual violence report is that there are zero state dollars that are committed to the primary prevention of sexual violence, on stopping this violence that uses sex before it occurs. And we are really committed to and want to bring you the message that the primary prevention of sexual violence, in other words, strategies that address that upriver front-end activity that can change the social norms that condone and support sexually violent behavior. Additionally, in terms of costs, we spend 45% more in Minnesota on housing and addressing the needs of offenders than we do on providing access to justice, health, or the well-being of victims and survivors. Shortly, just briefly, I want to say that in an effort to increase the conversation about prevention in Minnesota, MnCASA hosted and convened in December the Minnesota Summit to Prevent Sexual Violence, to which we invited 200 leaders from the state, from various sectors across the state, to spend a day with us imagining and brainstorming what we can all do and how we all have a role in the prevention of sexual violence. It isn't an issue that just resides with the criminal justice responders that you've heard from this morning, the treatment providers, not just the advocacy movement, but actually the business community, the faith community, industry, government. We all have a role to play, and that's what we discussed at that summit. There will be a report from the summit, which is being issued, where the outcomes and strategies that this group identified will be laid out so that you can see how we will be working along with many of our partners to advance prevention. That will be an electronic report that you will all be receiving a link to shortly, so that you can see the outcomes of the summit and see how we might continue to be engaged in conversation with you. At this point, I'm going to end my comments and actually turn over the chair to Dean Janis. I think that his comments are really relevant considering the presentations that you've heard this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn, for your presentation. Dean Janis, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Minority Leader Coles, and members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Eric Janis. I'm the Dean at William Mitchell College of Law. Of course, I'm here in my individual capacity, and my views are my own and not the college's. I've spent the last 10 or 15 years studying this issue, and in particular, I think what I'd like to talk about is some fundamental questions about how we're asking questions about preventing sexual violence. And what I want to propose is that the way we've been asking the questions has turned our resource allocation on its head. And as a result, we as a state have been putting most resources into a place where, in a sense, the least problem resides, and least resources where most of the problem resides. So my point, very briefly, is that frames make a difference, and that we ought to be thinking about the questions we're asking and then focusing on data and evidence when designing solutions. One key way we've framed our thinking about sex offender violence is recidivism. It's an important way of thinking about it, but to the extent that we put overemphasis on it, our policies and our attention gets misdirected. So I want to talk about recidivism for just a minute. How serious a problem is it? If we read the papers, we think that recidivism is the main problem. And the headlines scream about recidivist violence. And of course, recidivist violence is very upsetting to us. Let me talk about some of the data here. There was an important study by the United States Department of Justice that actually tracked all sex offenders released in 1994 from 15 states, about 10,000 sex offenders. 3-year follow-up. This is not the longest follow-up study there's been, but it did track these folks for 3 years. Here are the results. Approximately 95% of the sex offenders released in 1994 were not rearrested during the follow-up period for a new sex crime. Recidivism for a sex crime was 5.3%. For child molesters, recidivism was less, 3.3%. Again, this is a 3-year follow-up period. If you followed up for longer, the rates would go up, but this is helpful in dimensioning what the problem is.
Dean, is this sex offenders level 1, 2, 3, as we would classify in Minnesota, or is this...
This is all sex offenders released from prison in these 15 states during that 1994.
Very good. Thank you. Continue.
Other findings, and these are replicated in a number of different studies, sex offenders have a same crime reoffense rate that's among the lowest of all offenders released from prison. Sex offenders have an any crime reoffense rate among the lowest for all criminals. But here's the last finding that I want to focus on for just a minute, because this has attracted perhaps the most attention. Sex offenders in the study were 4 times more likely to be rearrested for a new sex crime than the non-sex offenders who were simultaneously released from prison. So in other words, if you looked at all of the offenders released from prison in 1994 and look at what their rate of sex crime recidivism was, it was 4 times less than the rate that sex offenders committed a new sex crime. This is logical. Somebody is committed into prison for a sex offense, it's likely that if they reoffend, it's going to be for a sex offense, more likely than somebody else. But here is the interesting fact in my mind, and this shows us that we have to be very careful when looking at these statistics. As pointed out by this DOJ study, despite the fact that sex offenders being released from prison had a higher rate of committing sex offenses, most sexual violence that was committed by released prisoners was committed by non-sex offenders. That is to say, if you looked at the community, at the 100,000 or so offenders who were released from prison in 94, and counted up all the sex crimes those offenders committed, only 13% of those sex crimes were committed by people who had been in prison before for sex offenses. 87% were committed by people who were in prison for non-sex offenses. I'm going to make this point in a couple of other ways. Recidivist sex crime is a tiny part of the problem of sexual violence. This is one example of it. Here's another example. If you take a look at all of the folks who are in prison for sex crime, presumably these are the worst folks. These are the people whose crimes have been discovered, who have been convicted, who have not been put on probation. They've been put in prison. Only 14%, about 1 in 7, of those people who are in prison for a sex crime have a prior history of a sex offense. I'm not saying that only 13% committed some sex offense in the past, but only 13% have a criminal history of a sex offense. In other words, again, if you look at sexual violence in our prisons, recidivist sexual violence, by recidivism, most people mean a crime committed by somebody who was previously convicted of a crime. Recidivist sex crime is a small part of the problem. Here's another way of looking at it. Well, okay, this slide summarizes what I just said. Let's think about MSOP, because MSOP is the flagship program that we have to deal with recidivism. You heard that we release every year from prison 600 to 700 sex offenders in this state. A small, but growing, but very small proportion of those folks are committed to Moose Lake or to MSOP. I'll be happy to provide you the background on this, but if you do the math, you will find out that most recidivist sex offenders are released into the community. In other words, of the 600 or 700 sex offenders who are released every year, most of those who are going to turn out to be recidivists are released in the community. They are not committed to MSOP. So to the extent we think that we're solving the problem of recidivism by committing a few people to MSOP, we're not. I'm not saying it's not accomplishing anything, but let's not fool ourselves, because most of the recidivists are being released into the community. One more.
Representative Quoth.
Mr. Chair, well, Dean, the people committed to Moose Lake aren't getting out. They can't recidivate.
That's absolutely right.
So help me understand the assertion that you're making, because obviously those folks who have been committed aren't recidivating. They're not getting out. So, of course, the people who are people who are released into the community.
Dean Janice.
What I'm saying is that if you look post-ante or pre take the position before people are committed, when they're being released, we're trying to predict who's going to be a recidivist and who isn't. Most of the people who are going to turn out to be recidivists are not being committed to MSOP. They are being released into the community. And here's the reason. We claim to be applying a very, very, I'll put it this way. We claim to be committing only the worst of the worst. Let's say we're committing 5%. What that means is that we are not committing the almost the worst of the worst. And we're not committing the almost the worst of the worst. So if we're committing the top 5%, we're not committing the other 95%. And that other 95% contains most of the people who are going to turn out to be recidivists. I'm not saying that most of those 95% are recidivists. But if you look at the group of people who are going to commit recidivist crime, most of them are being released.
I'll let Representative Cornish ask a question, but I think, in fairness, we should let him complete his presentation and see how much time we have left for questions. So go ahead, Representative Cornish. Do you want to ask the question?
Just one thing I wish you'd change about your presentation. Over at the Kelly Inn and here, you said that we think we're solving the problems. I don't think so. I don't think the chair thinks so. The governor doesn't think so. Mr. Benson doesn't think so. Nobody I've ever heard of in government has ever said we think we're solving the problem. I don't want to solve the problem. I'm happy solving the problem by locking them up and having them never get out, whatever problems they got. The other thing is that the only thing I disagree with your statistics in is that I was sending bulletin after bulletin here to the committee on email. Every sex crime I've seen so far has been committed by a previous offender in the paper. And somebody told me that's because the paper grabs out all the heinous crimes, but it's not true. They had every one. I can't find a sex crime that hasn't been committed by a previous offender that was let go by somebody or the system failed. So something in the statistics is skewered. I don't know how, but on the street, it isn't working out the way you say it is on the slide presentation.
Dean Janice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd be happy to provide the basis for that statement to your representative, if you like. I apologize. Maybe nobody is claiming to have solved the problem. That might be hyperbole. I know we all would like to solve the problem. Let me put it that way. And so here's how I look at it. We can think of sexual violence as a stream. And the Mincasa numbers suggest about 60,000 instances of sexual violence a year. We know that a small portion of those, or maybe 50%, probably less, are reported to authorities. Fewer are cleared. Fewer are convicted. When you get down to prison, that's a small, small portion of the sexual violence. And if we focus on recidivism, that is, as I've pointed out, a very small part of the entire problem. And to the extent we focus on recidivism, we fail to focus on root causes. So Nonetheless, most of our resources are going to deal with problems far, far downstream. This is the allocation of treatment resources not 10 years ago in 2000. I think the disproportion between civil commitment, community, and prison-based treatment has grown more severe since then. So the question, is our money addressing the problem? Where are the potential sex offenders? First, in the community. Second, in prison. Third, in MSOP. Where are we spending our public money? First, in MSOP. Second, in prison. And third, in the community. So, in my judgment, the frames we're using right now to think about solving the problem are the wrong frames. We're thinking about recidivism, trying to figure out who the most dangerous person is. We talk about sexual predators. Basically, we think that if we can figure out who the dangerous people are and keep them away out of my neighborhood, we'll be okay. We're trying to close the loopholes every time something we read about something in the paper. We think we can solve that problem by closing a few loopholes, and we think that we're sparing no expense. Here are some new frames I think we should be using. We should be looking at the data. And every time we work on a new policy, we ought to be asking, what's the data that suggests that this is addressing the danger? Instead of asking only who the most dangerous is, let's ask, where is the most danger? Let's ask where the root causes of sexual violence are. We need to own the problem as a society instead of thinking that we can excise a tumor that's the sexual predator and that will help us deal with the problem. What's our most effective use of money? And we ought to be thinking of a public health approach. And I'll end with that. A public health approach to sexual violence is comprehensive and systematic. It makes use of all types of intervention, primary, secondary, and tertiary. MSOP is a tertiary intervention. I'm not suggesting that that has no place. What I am suggesting is that we ought to be thinking about the allocation of resources in terms of comprehensiveness and systematic approach. We ought to be seeking out root causes. MSOP, prison sentences, have nothing to do with root causes. It ought to be evidence-based. We ought to be assessing what we do and determining what the best practices are. Best practices in the sense of which are the kinds of expenditures that most reduce sexual violence. Not just recidivist sexual violence, but sexual violence where it happens the most in the community. And then we ought to have a program for replicating best practices.
That all sounds good, Dean Janison. I think we probably all agree with it, but can you give some concrete examples of what that might look like in Minnesota or other states where best practices exist for prevention?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We know that, and I agree with the previous speaker, we know that supervision and treatment in the community are proven interventions that reduce recidivism. Are we spending the resources on those tried and true approaches for supervising sex offenders who have been identified? That's number one. Number two, do we have programs that serve victims of sexual violence, that facilitate people making reports of sexual crimes? Number three, how are we approaching the values and attitudes in our society that we all understand allow sexual violence to flourish? And of course, when we think about sexual violence only as the sexual predator, the stranger who attacks people in the parking lot, then we have a particular approach to it. But we know that that is not the modal sexual violence. So there are, and then finally, I would say that there are some clear solutions to the problem at MSOP. They would take some political courage. They do not require opening the gates. But, and I'll just say two things about that. Number one, our sister state of Wisconsin has a much different path. They have a sex offender commitment program just like we do. They have not gone down the same road we have, and they've had a much more successful, more balanced approach. Texas as well. I rarely hold up that state as an example, but they also have a program that's much less expensive and, as far as I know, fairly successful.
I'm not sure that you necessarily find the courage here, but can you give us an example of what we might do then to
Certainly.
if we are going to discuss the future of MSOP and what we're, where we're applying our resources, what might that look like based on Wisconsin, Texas, or any other state?
Yep, Mr. Chair. I think there are two pieces to that. Number one, we have to be, right now, on the input side, we have an all-or-nothing option. If you're committed, you are locked up for life, and you will not be a recidivist. If you're not committed, you're in the community, and who knows what the level of supervision is going to be there. We ought to have many more options there. That's number one. That will reduce the input. Number two, on the discharge end, we need to look carefully at who can be managed reasonably in the community. If anybody thinks that there are going to be zero risk discharges, that is not the case. We've never thought that. We're only putting in people who have the highest risk. When their risk can be managed at a somewhat lower level, they ought to be in the community. We heard our previous speaker say that one of the units at Moose Lake is the assisted care unit. Why are people who are in assisted care taking $100,000 a year resource from the state?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Dean Janis.
Thank you.
Have you taken a look at the prior criminal history or the number of offenses of the folks who we have civilly committed, so that as you're talking about those that we can manage in the community, you have a clear picture of how many times these folks have failed prior to us getting to the point of civilly committing them? Because frankly, a court has declared these people to be sexually dangerous, psychopathic personalities. And so it has been a lengthy process to prove that this person really is a danger to society before we admit them.
Representative Hillstrom.
Dean Janis.
Mr. Chair. Yes, well, I did a study. It's about 10 years old now, but I, along with a co-author, I did a study of all of the men who were committed as of about 1999, 2000. And I'd be happy to provide that study to you. It's the answer to your question quite directly is there's a whole range. It goes from people who have no adult offenses because they graduated directly from juvenile facilities and were committed, to people with 10, 12 prior offenses. So there's a whole range. So one mistake would be to think about the group homogeneously. They're not homogeneous. They're very heterogeneous. I'll give you one example. I interviewed a man who was committed. He had one offense. It was a over-the-clothes groping, not pleasant for the victim by any means, but that was what it was. He had a young man at the time. He had other disabilities. He was advised to essentially plead guilty to admit the petition, and because he'd be out in a couple of years. He's been in about 15 years now. Another gentleman I saw about 5 years ago, 77 years old at the time. His MO had been to attract teenage boys to a garage, offering beer and video games. I'll tell you something, you put this guy in an assisted living home where he's not around kids, and he's not a danger. So I think that what is needed is a case-by-case analysis. The question to be asked is, can we manage these people with a reasonable degree of assurance in the community? I think the answer would be quite a number of them can be.
I think another startling fact is, and I mean, this is what the legislature should be concerned about, in 2003 we committed 15 offenders to MSOP. Then the Rodriguez, the Druze Shedin tragedy happened, and we've been at a rate of 50 a year. I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but a crime like that can drive our policy, and I'm hoping that this is the start of a conversation that we continue to have during the legislative session. Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, I see that we have gone over our time. I could go on for a while.
I'm
so
sure you could.
We will be having additional hearings on this issue, I'm certain.
Thank you, Dean Janis. Thank you, Ms. Dunn, for your presentation. Sorry we had to abbreviate things. This meeting's adjourned.